The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Mo'adim l'simcha, Anthony Reich, how are you?
Mo'adim l'simcha, yes, Boker Tov. We did promise yesterday that we were going to discuss why we say Mo'adim l'simcha, where that comes from.
Let's do that.
And actually, Mo'adim l'simcha is more of a Sephardi tradition than an Ashkenaz greeting. But the whole point is that, you know, we have different levels of chag. The days in between days on Pesach and Sukkot are not considered to be a chag. So it's not appropriate to say chag sameach or good yom tov, as some people like to say in Yiddish, because it's not really a yom tov. It's not really a chag. It's considered to be a moed, which is not a regular day, but it's also not a chag. And so some people say moed tov, or gut moed, which comes from the Yiddish. Moedim l'simcha is more the Sephardi tradition. And then it is traditional to respond by saying chagim uzmanim l'sason, which comes from actually the kiddush of the chag, where we say moedim l'simcha chagim uzmanim l'sason, which is part of the kiddush. So that's the traditional greeting, at least, that the Sephardim use. But moed tov, just to be short, is fine. And what the general recommendation is that if you don't know what to say, then wait to be greeted yourself and respond accordingly.
Interesting. When you say, you know, throughout the world, when it's a holiday, we say Yom Tov, like a good day, a wishing. Unless you're in South Africa, in which case you say Yontif, Yontif. Right, Anthony.
Exactly.
Yontif.
And not only in South Africa, by the way. I mean,
oh, really?
It's just, you know, yeah. This is just people taking, you know, the Yiddish to, the extreme. But the other nice thing that I noted about Sukkot this year is that there's a sukkah in Dubai, right in the center of Dubai, that's been constructed. And this just kind of rolls on from the recent peace agreement that we saw, the so-called Abraham Accords. And now a sukkah proudly displayed in the middle of Dubai. Things have definitely come a long way in a relatively short time.
Amazing. I'm looking forward to those 9 other countries that they're currently working on peace deals with and see who they are.
We've tried to guess them. I haven't been able to come up with a full list of 9, but certainly there are some that we know about.
I think Saudi.
We've spoken. Saudi
Arabia.
Sure.
What about Qatar?
Qatar certainly is one of those countries. I think we're also talking about some African countries, potentially. North African countries are also part of that list, further afield away from the Saudi, away from the Arabian Gulf. You know, I'll tell you what, I'll try and put a list together to talk about it tomorrow, and maybe the listeners can do the same in the meantime. Let's compare our lists to see what we think the next countries may be.
Okay, fantastic. You've given me homework. Anthony, the IDF retaliated last night against a rocket fired towards Israel from Gaza. I actually saw the alerts going off, and I just thought, you've got to be kidding me. Like, what? So what happened?
Well, you know, at one stage we were kind of very accustomed to these rockets coming very frequently, and now not so much, because the last rockets that were fired from Gaza towards Israel were those that were fired right in the middle of the signing ceremony at the White House of the Abraham Accords, which actually was already on the 15th of September, so almost a month has gone by since then. And things have been very quiet in the south, thankfully, and just as well, especially for those people who live there, who've had to suffer a lot from the rockets that have constantly been falling in that area. It's not clear to anybody, or at least not in the press that I've read, as to who was particularly responsible for the single rocket that was fired last night. It did trigger code red warnings, people running to bomb shelters. Fortunately, the rocket itself landed in an open area. There was no damage reported, no injuries were reported. So at least, you know, that is a good thing. But the point is that there are still renegade groups operating in Gaza. We're not sure that we can necessarily blame Hamas. The Israeli government, of course, always holds Hamas responsible, no matter who the particular group was that fired the rocket. And the Israeli government says, even if it's not Hamas-controlled people who are firing the rockets, it is Hamas's responsibility to make sure that they don't fire these rockets, they don't allow any renegade groups to operate within Gaza in a way that they can endanger Israelis who live around that area. Particularly, let's not forget that some of those rockets have the capability to reach much further afield towards Tel Aviv and even further north of Tel Aviv. So even though the those people who live around the Gaza Strip are the ones who have suffered the most, the rockets are a greater threat. Obviously, it's a different type of rocket, and the very, very cheap rockets that are easy to fire, that don't really need a second thought because the cost is low, because they're easy to launch, and because they can be done relatively safely by those who launch them, because very frequently they're being launched from the backs of trucks. They simply launch it from the back of the truck, they pack everything up, and they run away to ensure that they can escape any retaliation from the IDF. Mm-hmm. So those are relatively simple, and unfortunately, it puts the people who live in the Gaza envelope area under much greater risk as a result. But we do know that the IDF then followed up with aircraft fire that struck a Hamas military installation in the southern area of the Gaza Strip. It seemed to be a very, very limited retaliation, not widespread at all. There were no casualties reported. We are not sure of the damage that was caused. But generally speaking, there is this kind of unwritten understanding between the two groups, between Hamas and between the IDF, that if the attack is not significant in the sense that it doesn't cause major damage or injuries, that it's relatively limited, that the response will also be limited in order not to create an escalation, because these escalations can very, very easily and very quickly result in a major operation which could potentially risk many, many lives indeed. So it seems a little strange that, you know, well, for one rocket will only kind of attack one little installation of Hamas without causing too much damage. I mean, that's what it looks like from the outside. And in fact, that's really what it is. Not because there isn't a desire to retaliate more severely, but because there is no desire at the moment to escalate the conflict beyond what it really needs to be. Because the moment there's any significant escalation, we know that our lives and theirs become at risk, and there's no desire to do that. So unfortunately, another rocket in the middle of Sukkot, unfortunately, very limited, and I think we probably will see the end of that for now, at least until the next one.
It must be very difficult for, I mean, when you refer to renegade groups, you know, and it's all very well Israel saying, you know, Hamas, we hold Hamas responsible for every rocket that comes into Israel, whether it's from a renegade or whether it's from, you know, from the Qassam Brigade, wherever it's coming from. Does the IDF share intel with Hamas, and does the intel work both ways in order to clamp down on renegade groups? Because it's in nobody's interest that there is a renegade group.
It's an interesting question, and one that I'm not able to answer completely. I can only speculate.
Yeah.
It would surprise me if the IDF was sharing any intelligence with Hamas, even if it felt that sharing that intelligence would help Hamas somehow to clamp down on operations in the Gaza Strip. And the reason that I feel that way is because sharing any level of intelligence at all, even if it seemingly helps your cause, also serves to divulge a lot about you. It divulges the extent to which you know things. Perhaps it divulges how you've managed to gain that information. It starts to open up a bit of a black box about some of the intelligence operations. Just by sharing a small piece of information, you can divulge quite a lot of secret information that you might not want other people to know about. Having said that, we do know that the intelligence is shared with the Palestinian Authority,
yeah,
in a limited sort of way. And, you know, it would be interesting to be a fly on the wall to understand how the security services managed to share that with the Palestinian Authority without sharing too much, because there's always the danger that you're just going to open up a little bit too much. So my speculation is that there's not much sharing going on with Hamas, but I may be wrong.
Okay, well, we will never know, Anthony, because I doubt anybody who can make a statement is going to. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about leadership, who are flouting lockdown.
Lack of it, as the case may be.
Yeah, absolutely. Who are flouting lockdown laws?
This is really just a crazy story. This law, Gila Gamliel, who is the Minister for Environmental Affairs, has walked into a storm because she has been accused of flouting the lockdown over Yom Kippur. She has a particular position because she has a particular situation because her husband is originally from Tiberias. His family are from Tiberias. Apparently, he at least owns a property in Tiberias, which is not the family's main residence. They live in Tel Aviv area, wherever, and they decided to go to Tiberias for Yom Kippur and live in the place that they own. Now, he apparently is formally registered to that property, while she is formally registered to their property in Tel Aviv. According to the Yom Kippur lockdown and the current lockdown that we're in at the moment, every resident is required to be at their home, which is registered on their ID card, on their identity document. And in that particular family's case, it is different between the husband and the wife, because the husband is registered in Tiberias and the wife in Tel Aviv. But as it turns out, Gila Gamliel and her family, her children, her husband, went to Tiberias for Yom Kippur. They even went to a shul, an indoor prayer service at a shul, which on Yom Kippur was specifically allowed under very, very stringent circumstances. But she has acknowledged that she might have thought about doing things differently now with the benefit of hindsight and being a little bit smarter. And she's volunteered to pay the relevant fine that would apply to her for being in the wrong place at the wrong time during the lockdown and for going to that shul. By the way, that particular shul was then has had 20 people diagnosed with coronavirus. And of course, the one little important piece of information that I forgot to mention is that Gila Gamliel herself has coronavirus now, following all of that. And of course, that shul also has been infected, a number of worshippers from that shul. So very, very controversial indeed. And unfortunately, our leadership is just not leading us at the moment. If this is how our government ministers are behaving, what can we possibly expect from the 5,000 people who turned up at the rabbi's funeral yesterday in Ashdod? Why should they not do that if our government ministers are not adhering to the rules themselves? Why is it okay for the police to go and break up that funeral where 5,000 people are gathered and nobody's respecting social distancing and all the rest of it, of a senior rabbi who himself died of coronavirus, ironically, and now all the worshippers are coming along, all the followers and supporters are coming along to support? Why is that okay? Why is the, you know, the government ministers flouting the rule acceptable? Prime Minister Netanyahu has refused to criticize his fellow party member and member of his government, saying we need to find out what the situation, what the real facts are before we can make any judgments. That's his way of saying he's not going to criticize. So, but I think time came for our government ministers and from our senior leaders, including senior rabbis, to stand up and be counted and to show that adhering to the rules is important.
Anthony, what are your figures looking like? Has the hard lockdown that was implemented before Rosh Hashanah, what was that, 3 weeks ago, has it had any influence or any impact on the infection rate in Israel?
We are being told that it does, that it has had an impact, that the number of infected, the currently infected people has gone down. In fact, the number of people, serious cases at the moment, apparently is 875, according to the latest statistics that I've seen, and that there are more than 200 people being intubated in hospitals at the moment. We've had 1,757 people die. And unfortunately, people are still dying at a rate of 10, 20, 30 a day, even though there has been a flattening out of the graph and that the number of currently infected people has reduced slightly than what was the case previously. But certainly not enough for us to say we're out of the woods and we can let things up, even though there's a lot of talk about already easing the restrictions, potentially allowing school children back to school, at least kindergarten children, primary school, intermediate school, you know, the younger ages, so that parents can get back to work. There's already talk about them returning to school after Simchat Torah sometime next week. I feel it might be a little bit early still, now that we've already gone into the lockdown, but we need to keep our economy moving. And the real challenge for us at the moment, for all of us, is how do we keep the economy moving and keep ourselves staying healthy? And so far, I don't see any country that has really got a good answer for that.
Yeah, 100%. Maybe New Zealand. Maybe perhaps. New Zealand. Okay.
Yeah,
Anthony Reich, we'll catch up with you tomorrow, and let's talk airlines tomorrow.
Let's talk airlines and supermarkets, and let's talk the list of countries that perhaps are next on the list for signing a peace agreement.
Amazing. Clive's thrown his hat in the ring, or his suggestion in the ring, and he says Kuwait. He thinks that Kuwait is going to be one of those 9 countries. Anyhow, that's where we leave it. Anthony Reich, thank you very, very much. If you want to find out what else Anthony Reich has to say as our Israel correspondent, then contact him via his blog. It's called Comments from the Edge.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.